You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Good evening and welcome. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you so much, Justin. It is my great pleasure to introduce our moderator tonight, who is going to introduce our distinguished guests. We have a distinguished moderator as well. Bridget Mullins plays, that's Bridget over there to my left, have been produced in New York, London, and San Francisco. She's written Monkey in the Middle, Fire Eater, Topographical Eden, Pathological Venus. She has great titles. She's received many awards and fellowships, and previously, before she was the director of the Master's in Professional Writing Program at USC, was directed the Creative Writing Program at Harvard. For 15 years, she also curated the reading series at the Dia Art Foundation in New York. As I said, she's an award-winning playwright, and her plays have been produced in many places. And most of all, she's a, from my point of view, a wonderful collaborator. Bridget and I love to sit in various coffee houses and make long lists of writers we dream about bringing to L.A., and tonight you'll get to enjoy the fruits of one of those conversations as she moderates a conversation with Yi-Yun Lee and Sarah Swanyan Bynum. So please welcome our three distinguished guests to the Los Angeles Public Library. After the conversation, before I forget, you will be invited to ask questions. We'll circulate a microphone. Please wait until it comes to you because we record for podcast. And afterwards, our guests will be signing their books in the lobby. Thank you so much.
I'm honored to be part of this most interesting series of evenings. And I'm so fascinated by the work of these two writers. And I'm here to situate the conversation, so I'm sort of a fly on the wall, and as you know, it's a fourth wall, so as you feel questions and observations brewing, be sure to remember them, because we will have time at the end for your participation. So the title of the evening is The Short Story in the Art of Not Knowing, and to my mind, the short story is sort of like the lyric poem, and it's carved out of time in a certain way. Both Sarah and Ian write masterfully in this form. And the short story, which is characterized not by slightness or spareness, but by length and by word count. There is considerable depth and breadth in their stories, and they both explore places that are ineffable and experiences that feel untranslatable through language. So it's really with a sense of wonder that I read and reread their work to see how they pulled it off. It's a sort of linguistic legerdemain. Sarah Swanyan Bynum was born in Boston and has lived in Brooklyn and in Iowa City and currently lives in Los Angeles. She is the author of two novels, or two collections of linked short fiction, Miss Hempel Chronicles and Madeline is Sleeping. Her awards include a Whiting Writers Award, an NEA Fellowship, and many other prizes. She also teaches, and she directs the MFA program in writing at UC San Diego. Ian Lee is the author of two collections of stories, most recently Gold Boy, Emerald Girl, and from 2005, A Thousand Years of Good Prayers, and a novel, The Vagrants. She is a native of Beijing, and she traveled to the University of Iowa as a science student in 1996 to study immunology, but her scientific studies were interrupted and replaced by her writing. She, too, is the recipient of many, many prestigious awards, and most recently, the MacArthur Genius Grant. She teaches writing at UC Davis. Both Ian Lee and Sarah are graduates of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I believe they studied under at least one of the same teachers. We'll find out. And they were both recently named two of the 20 under 40 fiction writers of note by the venerable New Yorker magazine. They have each earned considerable critical acclaim, even as they keep their cool and continue writing deeply idiosyncratic and compelling stories. Flannery O'Connor says that the ideal reader has, quote, the kind of mind that is willing to have its sense of mystery deepened by contact with mystery. And so tonight we will be the ideal listeners to Sarah and to Ian. First, Sarah will read from her short story, The Earl King, and then Ian will read from her most recent collection. So I will turn the mic over to Sarah.
Thanks, Bridget. And so exciting to be with two writers I admire so much, and also to be here at the Aloud series. I've been sitting in the audience many times, so it's thrilling to be up here. And I make a weekly journey to the John C. Fremont branch of the LA Public Library with my daughter. So I feel a special sense of gratitude to the LA Public Library and what it's brought to my life and her life. So it's really special for me to be here. So I'm going to read just the opening of a story called The Earl King. It is just as Kate hoped. The worn path, the bells tinkling on the gate, the huge fir trees dropping their needles one by one, a sweet mushroomy smell, gnomes stationed in the underbrush, the sound of a mandolin far up on a hill. We're here," she says to her child, who isn't walking fast enough and needs to be pulled along by the hand. Through the gate they go, up the dappled path, beneath the firs, across the school parking lot and past the kettle corn stand, into the heart of the elves' fair. Her child is named Ondine, but answers only to Ruthie. Ruthie's hand rests damply in hers, and together they watch two scrappy fairies race by, the swifter one waving a long string of raffle tickets. "Don't you want to wear your wings?" Kate asked that morning, but Ruthie wasn't in the mood. Sometimes they are in cahoots, sometimes not. Now they circle the great shady lawn, studying the activities. There is candle making, beekeeping, the weaving of God's eyes. A sign in purple calligraphy says that King Arthur will be appearing at noon. There's a tea garden, a bluegrass band, a man with a thin sandy beard, and 100 acorns pinned with bright ribbons to the folds of his tunic, boys thumping each other with jousting sticks. The ground is scattered with pine needles and hay. The lemonade cups are compostable. Everything is exactly as it should be, every small elvish detail attended to. But as Kate's heart fills with the pleasure of it all, she is also made uneasy by the realization that she could have, but did not, secure this for her child. And therein lies a misjudgment, a possibly grave mistake. They had not even applied to a Waldorf school. Kate's associations at the time were vague but nervous-making. Devil sticks, recorder playing, occasional illiteracy. She thought she remembered hearing about a boy who, at 9, could map the entire Mongol Empire but was still sucking his fingers. That couldn't be good. Everybody has to go into a 7-Eleven at some point in life, operate in the ordinary universe. So she didn't even sign up for a tour. But no one ever told her about the whole fairy component. And now look at what Ruthie is missing. Magic, nature, flower wreaths, floating play silks, an unpolluted, media-free experience of the world. The chance to spend her days binding books and acting out stories with wonderful wooden animals made in Germany. Ruthie wants to take one home with her, a baby giraffe. Mysteriously, they have ended up in the sole spot at the Elves' Fair where commerce occurs and credit cards are accepted. Ruthie is not even looking at the baby giraffe. With some nonchalance, she keeps it tucked under her arm as she touches all the other animals on the table. "A macaw," she cries softly to herself, reaching. Kate finds a second baby giraffe caught between a buffalo and a penguin. Although they represent a wide range of the animal kingdom, the creatures all appear to belong to the same dear, blunt-nosed family. The little giraffe is light in her hand, but when she turns it over to read the tiny price tag stuck to the bottom of its feet, she puts it down immediately. $17. Enough to feed an entire fairy family for a month. Noah's Ark, looming in the middle of the table, now looks somewhat sinister. Two by two, two by two, it adds up. How do the Waldorf parents manage? How do any parents manage? Kate hands over her visa.
Thank you so much. And now, Yun Lee.
Well, how do I follow? Is that I'm going to read from the Fairy Guan of Chinese Army. This isn't a story in it's called Kindness. I'm going to read sort of in the middle. This is a woman in character, and she at this moment she was in the Chinese Army, and she read English when she was in Beijing, so she read a lot of English novels. The civilian world slowly crept in on us in the form of letters from old school friends and packages of chocolate sent from parents, memories of childhood holidays and teenage expeditions, and in my case, Professor Shan's voice reading D.H. Lawrence, her tone unhurried. "Well, Mabel, and what are you going to do with yourself?" When I closed my eyes at the shooting range, I could hear her voice, and the question, posed from one character to another, now seemed to request an answer from me. Or else, to her father, she was the princess. To her Boston aunts and uncles, she was just Dolly Urquhart, poor little thing. The point of a boot kicked my leg, and I opened my eyes. I was not in Professor Shan's flat, released momentarily from responsibility by her voice, but face down, my elbows on sandbags, my right cheek resting on the wooden stock of a semi-automatic rifle. The late October sunshine was warm on my back, and 200 yards away, the green targets, in the shape of a man's upper body, stood in a long line. Two magpies chattered in a nearby tree. In the last locust of the season, brown with grinning patterns, sprung past the sandbags and disappeared into the yellowing grass. I shifted my weight and aligned my right eye with the front and the rear sights. The training officer did not move, his shadow cast up on the sandbags in front of me. I waited, and when the shadow did not leave to check on the next girl, I pulled my trigger. Apart from a crack, nothing happened. It would be another 2 weeks before we could be given live ammunition. "Do you think you got a 10 there?" asked the training officer. "Yes, sir," I said, still screaming at the target. He sighed and said he did not think so. "Try again," he said. I held the rifle closer so that the butt was steadied by my right shoulder. I had noticed that people, once put into an army, become two different species of animals. Those who were eager to please like the most loyal, best-trained dogs, and those who, like me, acted like the most stubborn donkeys and needed a prod for every move. I looked through the sights and pulled the trigger. "Much better," the training officer said. "Now remember, the shooting range is not a place to nap." Shooting practice was one of the few things I enjoyed in the army. Major Tan showed up occasionally to inspect us, but since aiming was one thing we had to practice on our own, he had little patience for staying. The three platoon leaders, including Lieutenant Wei, sat in the shade of ash trees and chatted while two of the shooting officers for the company, who liked to sit with them, told jokes. Our officer, older and more reticent, sat a few steps away and listened with an indulgent smile. The two girls on my right talked in whispers, and now and then I caught a sentence. They were discussing boys, analysis and guesses that I did not bother to follow. On my left, Nan hummed a tune under her breath while maintaining a perfect shooting position. I was amazed at how soldierly she could act, her postured perfect in formation drills, her impeccable bed-making winning her titles in the internal affair contests. Anyone could see her mind was elsewhere, but the military life seemed to provide endless amusements for her. She never misbehaved, and she was among the few who hadn't received any public humiliation. I turned my head slightly, still resting my right cheek on the stock, but looking at Nan rather than the target. Her uniform cap was low on her eyebrows, and in the shadow of the cap, she squinted with a smile, singing in a very low voice. "The last rose of summer," she told me when I asked her about the song during the break. One girl overhearing our conversation asked Nan to sing it. She stood up from where we were sitting in a circle and flicked dried grass and leaves from her uniform. Her voice seemed to make breathing hard for those around her. Her face, no longer appearing amused, had an ancient, ageless look. I wondered what kind of person Nan was to be able to sing like that. She seemed too aloof to be touched by life, but how could she sing so hauntingly if she had not felt the pain described in those songs? The shooting range was quiet when Nan finished singing. A bumblebee buzzed and was shooed away, and in the distance, perhaps over the hills where a civilian world would not be seen, a loudspeaker was broadcasting midday news, but we could not hear a word. I think I'm just going to stop here. Yes.
So I'm really struck just hearing you read, as I'm sure the audience is, by the musicality in each of the pieces and the specificity of the world. And they're such a different world that you write from. But this form of the short story seems to be a place of overlap where you both are very interested in this short form and you excel at it. And I wonder about that. I wonder about the choice of the story, if it is a choice, if it's just an organic affinity to the form, and that something has this heft of a story rather than a novel, or rather than the shortness of a poem or an essay. And so I just wanted to ask both of you about that, about the form itself. What is the attraction, and what's the ongoing challenge?
I'll go first. Sarah's looking at me. I've only written one novel, but I realize novel is a journey that you can take only once with your characters. You write to the end, and after I finish my novel, I have never reread my novel again. I just feel that's done. And with short stories, it's different. I think the characters in my stories, or characters in any of the great short stories, they are alive. They live on. They live on. And sometimes you meet in this, you see them in the street, or sometimes you run into them in the shop. So in a way, I think, you know, I don't know if it's the condense of their life or the time they live, but they always have so much energy that they refuse to leave me alone, and they refuse to die on me. Mm. And that's why I'm always drawn to the short stories.
I think I'm drawn to writing short stories because I love reading short stories. And the novels that I tend to like, with the exception of the great 19th century novels, tend to be very slim novels. And I don't know if that just speaks to my own disabled attention span. But I do like the sense of, you know, you use the term worlds. I like how you can enter into a world in a short story and then return, that you can read it in one sitting, and that you can then return out of that world and look at your own surroundings in a, that your own surroundings sort of have a changed light about it. So I like the fact that you can have this full experience just in one sitting. I think also having young children too
that's right, that's
is one of the things that makes both reading and writing short fiction easier. I think a lot about Grace Paley and juggling family life and juggling activism and then squeezing in some short stories.
Yeah, or Lydia Davis.
Lydia. Yeah.
Well, that I mean, and there's so much to talk about here because it's so interesting, like that the life and the work and how you live those things and so deeply with the writing. And I'm just to go back to what you said about the writers who inspire you. Every writer starts as a reader. And so I'm wondering about that with your own reading, with the short stories. I do hear echoes when I read your work, and there's such a stylistic difference, and it's so interesting. I mean, Sarah, you have this sort of drenched lyric linguistic quality, and you and your work is so precise and detailed. And I'm thinking there's also this sense of a world that reminds me of the Irish writers, of course, and that allusion to The Last Rose of Summer, mm-hmm. which, you know, I invite you to sing for us if you like.
Oh, gosh.
do you want to tell us about that song for those who don't know, that the great Irish song?
It is an Irish song, yes. Written really early, yeah. I think. It's actually a very sad song. When I was writing the Kindness, when I was writing the novella, actually, I went on, there was one Irish band or two singers, they were singing some on the YouTube. I listened to them probably like 100 times just to get into that mood, that, you know, sorrowful mood.
Mm-hmm.
But you should talk about the poem more than I do.
So it's a poem by Thomas Moore, but yes. it has that incredible ancient sort of Irish sadness. And yes. And I know that you're drawn to the work of William Trevor, and he's been a model for you. But I also hear Chekhov in your work, and I see this, you know, and maybe partially it's the training as a scientist too.
You know, back to what Sarah said, you know, you want, I think you become a writer to write, to talk to your masters. And for me, I think, you know, talking in my writing to these great masters is really the most important thing for me. So I do talk to Chekhov. If I can find one line in my story that, you know, I'm imagining Chekhov love it, I mean, then it makes my day.
That line in one of the stories, I have nothing to say about this world.
Oh, yes.
That she repeats. That's very Chekhovian, it seems to me. It's sort of like, okay. And there is also something about the repetition, like the fugue-like structure of some of your works. Yeah.
I do love Chekhov. I'm sure you love Chekhov. You know, it's hard not to love Chekhov.
Yes. Love Chekhov.
And Trevor. You know, Trevor is a major influence. And also, you know, there are a couple of writers, and John McGaughan, also an Irish short story master, and V.S. Pritchett, who nobody reads now, but I love Pritchett a lot.
There's also this affinity for writers who had some experience of exile, it seems, or leaving. And the Irish, of course, like Joyce and Beckett, who gave up the language, and mm-hmm. just this thing of leaving a former self behind, which you did with both your occupation as a scientist. I read somewhere that you wanted to be the Chinese Madame Curie.
That's right.
And then also coming into a new language, which just seems like an extraordinary, like, double whammy in terms of a self.
You know, I realized I loved Madame Curie because when I was young, I read her biography again and again with those, you know, blue and red pencil marking every line. And I realized in the end I was reading her as a fiction, as a character.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I was imagining her life. Yes. So no, I didn't become Madame Curie, sadly. But I love English language. It's the only language I used to write. So I loved it. I fell in love with the language.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Sarah, with your language, your first book, Madeline is Sleeping, is seems like it's dream fragments, and you both write from dreams, and I'd be so interested to hear both of you speak about anything about how you use dreams in your work or as a mechanism. But your first book, it seems to me like it's so wildly experimental in a way. It's so, you really bring this whole new way of thinking and saying into being. There's this fairy tale aspect. And then in the Miss Hempel Chronicles and in The Earl King, there's an element of psychological realism that you're doing that's a real character study. And it just seems like it's just, you do them both so elegantly. But in terms of a language, it does seem like you have this ability to cross quadrants. Does that make sense? could you talk about that? Because that's so striking to me, the difference between the two books, but the similarities as well.
And to also answer the question about influences or inspirations. Mm-hmm. I almost think with each project sort of has its own constellation of guardian spirits. and in the case of Madeline, Italo Calvino and Angela Carter and Borges were, and Penelope Fitzgerald too, were really important sort of guardian spirits of that project, and I kept rereading their work as I was working on it. I know some writers don't read other writers at all when they're working on their own fiction. Do you read other writers?
I do. I have to start my day reading Trevor. Yeah. I want to write.
Yes, you have to get into that space.
Exactly. I do it too, like in an almost kind of ritualized way. So sort of I had a little stack of books as I was working on Madeline, and a totally different stack of books when I was working on Miss Hempel. Joy Williams, Deborah Eisenberg, Stuart Dybeck, who we both shared as a teacher, Stuart Dybeck, Alice Munro. Those were the sort of muses for that project. But when I look at writers who's sort of the trajectory of their careers that I really love, are writers like Penelope Fitzgerald or Italo Calvino, who seem to redefine themselves with each project. I mean, I've only gotten two books done, but I hope one. I hope that I can have that same sense of eclecticism eventually.
Oh yes, you would. I mean, can I ask you? Can I just ask about Penelope Fitzgerald? Because when you said that, all of a sudden it makes sense. You know, she has that really mischievous.
Yes.
In her.
Yeah, I'm thinking of At Freddy's, which actually has some of that same kind of, you know, sparkle of childhood and sort of the great pleasure and delight of being a child, but also the sense of danger. And that's something that I noticed in The Earl King, that it seems like there's a fate at work, and it actually seems in both of the stories that you read from, there's a kind of shape or a fate that the characters have and that they're going towards. But the way that they get there does seem mysterious to me. Like the ending of The Earl King, which I had to read like four times, just out of the sheer magic of it to understand what I'd been shown. So I'd love to hear about your process with
you talk about
with
the
both
Earl King
of the
too?
Stories. Yes. Yeah, what is an Earl King?
I'm curious.
Well, in talking about the conversation we're going to have, both Bridget and I were thinking of what Flannery O'Connor had said on the subject of knowing where your story is going. And Flannery O'Connor was quite emphatic on the subject that it is, in fact, better not to know where your story is going. And as she put it, if you don't discover something in the process of writing it, it's very unlikely that your reader will. So she really believed that, and I think this also has to do with the idea of sort of brushing up against mystery and being open to the mystery that can be revealed when you're writing a story and you don't know where it's going. Mm-hmm. So that I've always sort of stuck very faithfully to that philosophy of going into a story and really never knowing what the next page is going to hold, much less what the ending is going to hold. So it was funny writing the story, The Earl King, because I was writing it for an anthology of contemporary fairy tales. And Kate Bernheimer, who's a wonderful writer, novelist, and short story writer, who is editing the anthology, asked each of us to choose a favorite fairy tale and reimagine it. And of course, with working from a fairy tale, you know how it ends. And in the case of The Earl King, I was working with the Goethe poem that tells the Earl King tale. The last line of the poem is in the father's arms, the child is dead. Now that's a real bummer to start writing a poem, like writing a story, and knowing that that's the last line that you're writing towards. So one of the mysteries that arose for me out of writing this story was, how do I adhere to the arc of the Earl King tale while not feeling as if I'm sort of hurtling inevitably towards the death of a child. And as a result, I think the end is a little ambiguous.
it's not a strangulation of an ending. It's an opening of an ending. And maybe could you read the last paragraph for us?
Sure.
It's quite marvelous.
So at this point in the story, they've made their way through the Waldorf Fair and into a special room where they're selling Waldorf dolls. But Ruthie's own surprise is already turning into something else. Not a beautiful secret anymore, but just a thing that she knows will happen, whether she wants it to or not. Just as she knows that she will have an accident in the barn, and her giraffe will be lost, and her mother will keep looking at the tags hanging from the doll's feet, looking closely like she's reading an important announcement, looking closely and not seeing the puddle getting bigger on the floor. When it happens, her mother will be holding her hand. She is always holding and pulling and squeezing her hand, which is impossible, actually, because Ruthie, clever girl, kind girl, ballet dancer, thumb sucker, brave and bright Dorothy, is already gone.
A wonderful story. And a haunting kind of energy at the end, just a shimmer of energy.
Yeah, I just couldn't quite say she was dead.
Yeah.
But it was really a different experience for me trying to write from something that already had a shape.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of your last pages?
I do. It's very interesting you talk about the shape. I don't know my last page, but I know the shape of my story.
Mm.
I often know the shape, or I hate to use the word arc, but I think I know the shape of the story. So I'm writing towards that shape. But oftentimes I get there from a different route than, you know, that's just surprise you. Yeah.
And do they start, sometimes, I know this is a question you'll probably get all the time, but does it start with character? And one thing I'm thinking about, Eun, with kindness is it just seems like Moyenne, is that how you say her name? She, which also sounds Irish, as we pointed out before.
Yes, that sounds Irish.
There does seem to be something circular in the story, where at the beginning, Lieutenant Wei says, "How can we make you happy?" That's the memory, and it keeps revolving. And then there's a sort of an egg shape in the story. And there's this passage on five where Moyenne has a memory of being 5 years old and the peddler. I was wondering if you would read it, because I think it's such a swift and elegant way to introduce us to the character without oversaying too much. I mean, I think you're both talking about gaps, which is also something Chekhov does. He leaves things out, and he writes around a quality, as you've done with kindness, as a sort of...
Let me just read this. When I was five, a peddler came to our neighborhood one Sunday with a bamboo basket full of spring chicks. I was trailing behind my father for our weekly shopping of rationed food, and when the peddler put the chick in my palm, its small body soft and warm and shivering constantly, I cried before I could ask my father to buy it for me. We were not a rich family. My father worked as a janitor, and my mother, ill for as long as I could remember, did not work, and I learned early to count coins and small bills with my father before we set out to shop. It must have been a painful thing for those who knew our story to watch my father's distress, as two women offered to buy two chicks for me. My father, on the way home, warned me gently that the chicks were too young to last more than a day or two. I built a nest for the chicks out of a shoebox and ripped newspaper, and fed them water softened millet grains, and a day later, when they looked ill, aspirin dissolved in water. 2 days later, they died. The one I named Dot and marked with ink on his forehead, the first one to go, followed by Mushroom. I stole 2 eggs from the kitchen when my father went to help a neighbor fix a leaking sink. My mother was not often around in those days. And I cracked the eggs carefully and washed away the yolks and whites. But no matter how hard I tried, I could not fit the chicks back into the shells. And I can see to this day the half shell on Dot's head, covering the ink spot like a funny little hat. I have learned since then that life is like that, each day ending up like a chick refusing to be returned to the eggshell.
And when I remember reading that, and it stood out to me like with the force of a soliloquy of this character, and all the recognition of death, and there's something about death and childhood and rites of passage that I think also links the stories. And you have this, yes.
And I mean, talk about development of character, naming the two chicks Dot and Mushroom so swiftly and beautifully and gracefully conjures up who this particular child is. Both her literalness and her whimsy. Mm-hmm. Just such beautiful storytelling there.
And so unexpected, you know, it's just a Dot and Mushroom and that they had been marked. And also that the sort of aphorism at the end, which you do sometimes, which I've learned since then, that life is like that, each day ending up like a chick refusing to be returned to the eggshell. And throughout there will be these kinds of almost like koans or
epigrams.
Things worth repeating that could bring solace, but maybe don't, but you have them there. Sarah, you have this wonderful character of Miss Hempel, who's so interesting. And, you know, it's interesting because Moyen is also a school teacher. They're both middle school teachers. But the teaching doesn't come into Moyen's story, but it is Miss Hempel's story. Can you talk a little bit about where Miss Hempel came from, how she occurred?
Now is confession time, because I learned on arriving that the head librarian of the whole LA Public Library system is, in fact, the parent of one of my former seventh grade students from Brooklyn. So it really felt like, wow, coming full circle. So a lot of Miss Hempel was drawn from my own experiences as a middle school teacher. But you write a lot about teachers. You have a great sympathy for teachers.
Oh, I don't. This character. Sorry. Moya said I don't love my students. Let's carry on with Miss Hempel.
Well, I mean, I think, and actually it's some of the teacher characters in the Yun stories. It's a sense of teaching sometimes being a place where you kind of reach a dead end in your life. The painter. But for me, I think one of the pleasures of about working in the short form is that I thought I had written my teacher story, and then a few years later, I realized, oh no, I ran into Miss Hempel at the convenience store, and I realized that this was a character that still had some more life in her, and so I wrote the Miss Hempel stories over maybe, you know, 8 or 9 years, and would just return to that character in a very sporadic, but also I think organic way when I felt like, oh yeah, there's something else I meant to say, or there's something else that reminds me of how Miss Hempel would navigate this.
Did you learn things about Miss Hempel when you were writing her? Were there like moments of that Flannery O'Connor, that story that we're talking about, that Flannery O'Connor describes in Mystery and Manners, is her story, Good Country People,
where the preacher steals the wooden leg of the philosophy professor, and it's very funny and harrowing. And Flannery O'Connor says, "I didn't know he was going to steal that leg until seven sentences before I wrote it." And you know, one could look at that philosophy professor and find some similarities to O'Connor's life, and you know, and it's, so there is an element of grafting of a self in that one. And I'm just wondering if Miss Hempel had some, if there were some surprises in the writing of that character.
Oh, lots of surprises. And it's especially interesting when you're using elements of your own life in terms of creating a character, because then sometimes the surprises are even greater when things really depart from the record. Or sometimes I would start out a story, you know, with every intent of Miss Hempel going in one direction. One of the stories in the book is called Yurt, and I introduced this seedy Irish bar where all the teachers go after school on Friday and
Irish, yeah.
Yes. So it's and it's a place where they all drink too much and dance and play the jukebox. And when I started writing about the bar, and I imagined that the bar had two bathrooms, but one wasn't marked women and one wasn't marked men. It was up for grabs. And when I imagined these unmarked bathrooms, I was like, ah, oh, Miss Hempel's going to get lucky in one of these bathrooms by the end of the story. And I was so excited because Miss Hempel at this point was feeling a little discouraged. And there's a sexy physics teacher that appears in a number of the different stories. And I was like, perfect. I'm going to get Miss Hempel and Mr. Polidori in a bathroom on a Friday afternoon when too many Guinnesses have been drunk. And I got her into that bathroom. And it didn't happen.
Bummer.
And I was so disappointed for her. But it was a case, you know, just as Flannery O'Connor was saying, I did not see that coming.
I don't mean to scare you, but I do know your work, and I know where that passage is. Don't get frightened. Later, she would return to this moment.
Later, she would return to this moment, flipping it back and forth like a tricky flashcard, one that somehow refused to be memorized. She asked herself all the boring questions. Not pretty enough? Odd smell? But couldn't quite manage an answer. Causality kept escaping her. He kissed her, then he changed his mind. That was as far as she ever got. But always fascinating to her was the fact that she could feel him changing his mind. Feel it in her feel it in her muscles and on her skin. Not that he did anything so obvious as stiffen, and his body didn't once let go of hers, yet something shifted. The pressure that was once excited, now merely emphatic, the mouth still warm, but only reassuringly so, the embrace turning into a squeeze. His body's gracious withdrawal of interest in the very moment that he decided, no, this really isn't for me.
Oh, such a heartbreaking story.
Oh. Oh, no. And that was a surprise.
That was a surprise. I had other plans.
Yeah. So, what about this border between fiction and autobiography? And is this, have you written memoir? Are you interested in exploring that form?
No. I can't see.
No, but I do think, you know, I'm not an autobiographical writer, but like the story Kindness, I used a lot. I did draw a lot from my military experience. Mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, you write a story, like I oftentimes ask myself a question, and I ask myself questions that I cannot answer. So you write a story to explore the answers. Mm-hmm. You sort of set up these scenarios for the characters to live through those questions and see if they can find an answer for you. But actually, they never do find the answers for me.
And that story, Kindness, it does seem to be so much about what one person can be to another. And she goes through this series of friendships.
Yes.
That are, in some extent, unfulfilling.
Right. I mean, in a way, I think the kindness also is the unkindness from that story. You know, she was taken in by this professor to train her to read great English literature, but the professor also forbid her to fall in love with anyone, and she sort of just fall into that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's always very interesting. Kindness is always something that fascinates me. You know, kindness, when kindness becomes unkindness.
Mm-hmm. As a quality.
And yes. Yes, but we rely so much on kindness of others, you know.
Yeah, you have the kindness of strangers in a Tennessee Williams-like echo throughout, where it's, and there does seem to me to be some of that leavening of, like, we're not going to go the sentimental route in life. That would be a mistake. To see things clearly.
Yes. Yeah, I think for her, it's for the whole character of Moyana is to explore that question. And that, you know, she returned to loneliness, solitude. She chose mm-hmm. solitude in the end, very heroically.
Mm-hmm.
And I really respect her for that. But again, that's something that surprised me, even though I knew she would be choosing solitude. But still, the way, the absoluteness of her solitude just, you know, was to question me when I was writing it.
Did you choose, I mean, I... With the point of view, it's so interesting in your work because you have this communal point of view in Persimmons, where again it seems Irish to me. It's like the village talking in this sort of gossipy way. But this one, Kindness, is first person. Is it your only first person? Or?
That is my only first person narrator, and I have confession time. Yeah. I have to confess how I wrote that story, because we talk a little bit about influence, and that. I said, you know, I always write to talk to my masters. And that story was written particularly to talk to a William Trevor novella called Night at Alexandra. Mm-hmm. And in that novella, there was this provincial Irish town. He lived in a provincial town. He never married. So he started to talk about, you know, I'm a 58-year-old provincial. I have never married. And then he started to reminisce about his early life, about his teenage years when he fell in love with this older woman who's... I always hear her, Henry, do you remember me when you remember me? I'm the happiest woman in the world. That's what she said to him when he was younger. So he started to write that. So... When I wrote Kindness, I actually imagined my narrator talking to Henry mm-hmm. in The Night at Alexandra. But, you know, that's what fiction does, because in real life, you know, they were from different generations, from different countries. They would never mm-hmm. have met in any way. But she started, I imagined her story was told to him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first person. That's why the first person.
This is so... interesting, and I know that you all must have questions brewing. So I think this is the portion of the night where if you do have a question brewing, we have a couple of mics circulating. So great.
Hi, this is for you. And I haven't read your short stories, but my favorite book for this year has been The Vagrants. And you speak of kindness, and I think of that older couple, how kind they were, and I love that book. So is this part of what you incorporate in a lot of your stories?
The novel. You sort of see part of you in every character, even in your worst character, you see some of you. But the couple you were talking about, again, that's the kindness, and they were garbage collectors, so they collected. I actually read this in the Chinese newspaper a few years ago. There was this couple who did not, they made a living by collecting garbage. They collected, I think they collected 14 kids, all abandoned baby girls, and they raised the girls, but when the girls were at a certain age, the government would say they did not have legal residence. So they would take the girls away from them and send them to the orphanage. So I remember that story, so I like the couple a lot, because also, you know, speaking of how to imagine your couple, your characters, I did not know them at the beginning, and I realized they actually, in the end, I realized they were illiterate, so they were getting older, so there was no way for them to write down their memories, and already they lost 7 girls to the government. They could not remember them, so they started to tell the stories of each girl to each other, and that's how I got to them, yeah. And by storytelling, I think.
A question? I was wondering if you, Sarah, had read the Erlkönig in German and listened to the rhythm of that story in German before you heard it in English and then before you wrote the story.
I actually listened to the poem as it was sung. Schubert composed a song using the Goethe text, and I did listen to that over and over again. And one of the inspirations that came out of listening to the Schubert song was the idea of using different voices within the story. In the Schubert song, you hear both the child's voice and the father's voice, and the Erl King's voice as well. And so, in writing this, I broke one of my cardinal rules that I always browbeat my students with, which is when you're working in the short form, you need to commit to a single point of view.
Oh, no.
So, because one of the things I see a lot, especially with new writers, is a lot of unconscious shifting with point of view and a lot of slippage with point of view. But I thought, with the case of this story, oh, I would love to break my own rule. Because sometimes as a teacher, you get tired of hearing your own sort of adages. But the idea for having multiple voices very much came from listening to the Schubert.
And Sarah and Ewan both, this idea of breaking your own rules, or I was actually thinking of something, I think I'd read that you said that acid test, or your test of when a story works, is when there's a swerve. Joan Retallick's term of swerve, and it's sort of like a defamiliarization. Is that what swerve is? Can you talk about that? And Ewan, do you have like an acid test of how something works as well? Sarah, do you
Sarah,
want
to? Go ahead, and then I'll think about, I'll make up something here.
Excellent.
Well, I borrowed that term because I loved how she conceptualized the swerve as a moment when the familiar becomes strange. And I also think I tend to conflate that also with my sense of surprise. Often the moment when I become surprised in the story tends to be the same moment when the story swerves, both into a place that I didn't expect, but also in that swerve illuminating the landscape in an unexpected or strange way. So, you know, the bathroom stall, you know, becomes this site of discovery. So I always wait for that to happen. And if it hasn't happened yet, I feel like I have to keep fumbling my way through the story until that happens.
I didn't make up anything. I just agree with Sarah. I do think, you know, when you write, you make the familiar strange and you make the strange familiar. That's wonderful. So,
Professor E. Young, I read that while you were serving in the PLA, you carried a copy of James Joyce's Ulysses with you. I was just wondering, Well, I guess number one, did your companions think you were odd? And number two, did you read the entire book? And what did you get out of it? And how has it influenced any of your writings as of today?
Yes, actually, it's not Ulysses, it's Dubliners. Dubliners. So I went on to this march reading Dubliners, and we went on a march, and every day we would camp at a like village school or local meeting ground. And I remember just, you know, the sun was setting. I would just stand there and read Dubliners. And I mean, again, that's the Irish, you know, storytelling. And Dubliners is such a beautiful book. I actually had a very unsuccessful teaching moment just a few days ago. I often teach stories that I really don't like very well, but I was teaching the dead, and just it's very hard to teach to, you know, a bunch of 18, 19 year olds. They just kept complaining it was too boring for them, and in the end, I had nothing to say, so I just read the last part. You know, The snow was falling all over Ireland. I got more out of the book than probably a book got out of the story. But yes, so that's, yeah, I love, you know, the Irish storytelling.
Italo Calvino has an essay where he talks about that there are writers of the crystal and of the flame. The crystal who start with structure and then find the passion in their work and vice versa. And I wonder if each of you could talk a little bit about your process and in your drafts where you find that passion and where you impose that structure.
Great question.
That's actually very good. Are you a flame? Yeah.
I think I'd say maybe like an ember.
That's great. Do you want to talk about how you write as Amber?
I, you know, and I think part of the interesting question was the question of drafts. And I just made actually this guilty confession to one of the enormously talented graduate students who I get to work with, who is herself a really disciplined reviser. I made the confession today that I don't revise very much. Do you do multiple drafts?
Finish it. I'll finish your scandalous story and
scandalous confession. So I think I revise as I'm writing, and as a result I move forward very slowly. So this is an interesting question of how do you kind of like keep the fire going as, you know, you're slowly going sentence by sentence. But I love the sentence as a unit, and if I can write a sentence that feels like a muscular sentence, that gives me like enough of that little bit of fuel to go on to the next sentence. So I don't think about structure in a macro way, but I think I must be thinking about structure because I'm thinking so much about the sentence. And I wonder if by thinking a lot about it at the micro level, something begins to emerge at a macro level. Does that make sense? So yeah, a slow burn.
Slow burn. You know, it's very interesting. I used to say, oh, I'm just one draft writer. I never revise. But actually, I had this evolution as a storyteller. I think I used to do that too. Like, I write really slowly and just sentence by sentence. When I get there, I get there. I know I get a very solid story. But just recently, I think I became a bad storyteller. So, I wrote a story and... Oh, I thought it was a wonderful story, and I showed it to the New Yorker editor, and she said, it's so boring. And she, in her very kind and polite way, she's telling me part of the story was really boring. She said, you know, she I think, I don't know if you notice that if you have a strength, you have some strengths, it becomes your weakness mm-hmm. in the end. Mm-hmm. I think I notice that my strengths, it's more and more becoming what my weakness is. I write in a very quiet way. Mm-hmm. So I sort of mute everything, and now it's over-muted. They become really boring. So I think now I realize I have to do multiple drafts. So the first draft is actually very quiet and like proper story, but then you have to put fire in there, you know, stir something up. But it's very discouraging. I realize I cannot be a one draft writer anymore.
Do you share drafts with friends or classmates from Iowa?
I share drafts. I have two very good readers. I share drafts with them. And you know, one of them is Bridget, my friend, and she's actually a very sharp reader. She actually emailed me a couple of days ago. She said she quoted a line from my story. It's about, you know, it's a drizzly day with cloud or something. She said, "Who cares about a generic rainy day?" I think I need those really sharp comments just to help me focus. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
You share with your friends?
Yeah, again, I have two readers. Yeah. And is it okay if I do a shameless plug right now?
I think it's shameless plug time of the evening.
And one of my readers is Sarah Bronstein, whose first novel just was published this week. Mm-hmm. It's called The Sweet Relief of Missing Children. And so when I wrote The Earl King, I immediately sent that draft to her, and she had the insight into the story to say, I think maybe you need to have a little bit more of the child's point of view in the end. And that piece of advice really, so that was a case where I really did go back and add more in a second draft, you know, based on her.
Okay.
Really, you know, sharp reading.
Do you work with editor, or how's your editing process?
Well, it's so funny. I was going to ask you the same question because your new book is dedicated to Bridget Hughes,
yes.
Who's the editor of A Public Space. So, did your friendship evolve as a writer editor friendship, or were you friends before?
Right. Okay, now it's my, can I shameless plug?
Yes.
Do the plug. So I dedicated the story collection to Bridget Hughes, who edits this wonderful magazine, Public Space. And here, Antoine is our wonderful contributing editor here. I think our friendship started with, yes, I think she's always a very good reader for me. And also I think, you know, I think at certain point of the friendship, I realized, you know, I'm relying on her more than my own instinct. I can only write out of my own instinct. And she would ask very specific and basic questions. She would look at the story. She said, when is she happy? Is she ever happy? And then I would not know the answer. And then she would say, I think she's happy at this moment. And then she would list three moments. And then she would ask those questions, I think just to make me think, and I think she catches those moments. You know, sometimes when you write, when you don't know something, you just sort of gloss over very artistically.
And hope no one notices.
Yeah, that's exactly. Every time I don't know something, I write beautiful sentences, sort of just get the question out of the way, and she never lets me go. So that's how our friendship is.
Okay, two more.
Hi, thank you for coming here. I have two questions, actually. One for Sarah about Madeline is Sleeping. I was really struck by the book as an object and the space. Like, there's so much negative space, and I was wondering if you could sort of address the way that you constructed that. And then for both of you, I guess, also related to the book as an object and the way that you were talking about these characters that sort of have energy and are like running around, and the way that the novel is a journey. So instead of these short stories are kind of compressed together, like if that, how that makes sense to you guys, or
sorry
about the way these things these characters sort of exist within this container in a way, like, I don't know, I'm kind of abstract.
Well, I'm so grateful to hear you talking about the book as an object, because sometimes I worry that with the rise of the iPad and the Kindle, we forget about the weight of the object itself and how that can shape your experience reading the package that the story is delivered in. So when I was at Iowa, Iowa has a really great book arts program, and I got really excited about letterpress, about book design. I did great paper making classes there. So it was really neat to be writing Madeline and at the same time learning about how a book is made. So when the book was getting ready for publication, I had a lot of things to say. And fortunately, Harcourt was very receptive to hearing those things. So I had actually made a mock-up of how I hoped the book would look and what I hoped the trim size would be. And they were really receptive to that and let me pick the cover art, the Lewis Carroll photograph that's on the cover. So I did feel that those choices in terms of how the page was laid out and how white space was used and titles was a big part of how I imagined the story. So thank you for asking about that.
Is there another part of that question for Ian? Did you want to come in on that?
Well, I'll pass.
Okay. I think we have time for one short or small.
My question is your writing, does it come from your hands, your mind, or your heart? Do you write with emotions, memories, or just freeform?
Can you parse that out, or is it all together with the writing?
That's a very difficult
one. You got us.
Well, I think when you are, I don't know if it's for you, but because I hear you write sentence by sentence, I think in the middle of writing a story, it's more it's a mind thing.
Mm.
I don't know, but. But your heart has to be in there, or the story is dead, right?
And your body, too.
Oh, yes.
The body, I feel, so often gets overlooked in the writing process. I mean, my own body gets very overlooked. but one of the things I keep on trying to remember is that we experience the world through our bodies, through our physical senses, and some knowledge we acquire first through our bodies, you know, like Miss Hempel, having this understanding that she experiences first physically before she can sort of mentally grasp it. So I try to think about bodies and my characters' bodies a lot, and that writing comes from the body. That writing is. You know, even though we think of it as marks on the page, that it starts out as breath moving through your body. That sounds like so yoga teacher right now. But maybe not the hands in an isolated sense, but maybe the body in a more holistic sense, I hope, is where some of the writing comes from.
You did really well. I can't make up another answer now.
But I think that when we hear both of you read, also that connection of the voice, once you get your voices in your head, you go back to your work with this kind of renewed or this kind of insight around the world, which is the body, it is the voice. And we're at our conclusion for the evening. I want to remind you to vote, as Justin said, on L for library, yes.
And after this conversation, Sarah and Yoon will be in the lobby, and you can have your book signed. And then after that, there's going to be a cocktail party at Pino, that little bistro right outside. So we hope you'll join us for that. And please join me in thanking Yoon and Sarah for this gorgeous conversation.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.